Viewers of a certain age will no doubt remember Father Knows Best, the 1950s TV series that followed an idealized, uber-wholesome family from a homogenous Midwestern town as they worked through challenges such as the adoption of an unwanted dog, the closure of a favorite hangout, and the lack of a date to the Sadie Hawkins dance. Nostalgic fans hungry for a sequel might look to a raft of school reform measures advancing in the General Assembly this session. Some of the provisions would bar teachers from weighing in on potentially divisive social issues, including racism and gender inequality. Some would open schools and certain libraries to criminal prosecution for disseminating materials deemed harmful to minors. And in keeping with the belief that fathers and mothers always know best, some provisions would empower parents to review lesson plans, reject assignments, opt out of school mask and vaccine requirements, and block the delivery of mental health evaluations and services. For many members of the increasingly conservative General Assembly, such issues are, like the decades-old TV series, black and white. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll examine the highly charged education debate making headlines this session. Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house. Year in and year out, for a decade or more, education debates in the General Assembly have centered on many of the same familiar issues. Standardized testing, non-traditional education, teacher training and compensation, school district accountability, and so-called school choice. This year, well, not so much. To be clear, perennial issues haven't disappeared completely. Lawmakers still introduced pet bills on cursive writing, bullying, and school bus safety. But as I noted at the top of the show, hot-button social issues have dominated this session. Joining me to talk about the phenomenon and its long-term ramifications are Terry Spradlin, Executive Director of the Indiana School Boards Association and former Director for Education Policy at Indiana University Center for Evaluation and Education Policy, and State Representative Tanya Paff, a Terre Haute Democrat who serves on the House Education Committee and, perhaps more importantly for this discussion, has spent the past 28 years as a high school math teacher. Thank you both for being here for what I think will be an interesting discussion. Let's start with, you can't not talk about COVID, right? By all accounts, schools here and across the country are still reeling from COVID and its variants. Given that, what do the two of you think lawmakers should be focused on in terms of education and school improvement this session? Let's start, Terry, with you.
John, thanks for the invitation to be here. Thanks for that question. You know, it's a short session. We're going to be in for 8 or 9 weeks. We're in week four already. We'd ask legislators to focus on giving us the tools, resources, and local control to continue to manage through the situation. In July, the governor shifted kind of the duty and burden on adapting and pivoting to COVID with our health and safety protocols locally. And we've been working closely with the State Department of Health, all of our school districts. So for this session, we'd say, you know, let us continue our effort to keep kids in school and shy away from the efforts to inject more politics into the classroom. There's a lot of bills, you know, around partisan school board elections, other issues that would inject more politics in the classroom. We're saying, please don't do that. We're working hard to keep kids in school. Positivity rates have spiked again. Many of the counties, all counties were red just a short time ago. A few days ago or weeks ago. So these are still challenging times. COVID has been relentless. And so we're saying, give us the resources we need, which they did in the last budget session. We have done a great job in leveraging those resources to drive teacher pay. So that's been our focus. And getting, you know, highly qualified teachers in the classroom, keeping kids in the classroom. When it comes to education, students always come first. And that's what we're asking of them this session.
Well, Tanya Paff, how about you? What should lawmakers, you and your colleagues, be focused on in terms of education this session?
Well, you know, I would have, of course, thank you for having me here. I would always want more resources and help us recruit and retain teachers. You know, a lot of these bills that we're hearing this session are actually trying to drive teachers out. It certainly seems like it. A bill we heard yesterday, you know, I got over 900 emails asking me to vote against it. That does not help our teacher shortage. And, you know, we have to continue face-to-face instruction as much as possible. So, again, the General Assembly should be helping, trying to figure out a way to boost our profession, not hurt it.
Let me ask you, I mean, a lot of these bills, if you read them, you get the sense that schools are just, Indiana schools are you know, out of control. That, you know, homeroom teachers are distributing copies of Hustler magazine in the mornings, and then teachers are reading excerpts from Lenin and Marx after recess. I mean, what's the real picture? Let's start with you, because you're in the classroom and have been for close to three decades, Tanya. Do you have your copy of the Marx reader in your desk that you pull out on occasion?
So, you know, that's an interesting question, because I think if you ask any high school or middle school or elementary school what they're learning, none of what you mentioned. So on a typical day, in fact, I was just teaching the day before session. You know, we were just talking about algebra, because that's what we do. We're professionals. We educate our kids. Now, I'm not saying there aren't bad actors, but there's also a system in place for removing those. There may be a book in a school library that a parent disagrees with. It is not on every teacher's bookshelf, and we're not handing anything out like that. And if there's a book that someone disagrees with, again, there's a process in place. So no, I think if you went into any school today in Indiana, any public school, and walked in, you would hear probably what you heard years ago, just teachers teaching their subject and engaging students.
Have you heard from constituents who are concerned about the curriculum and the lesson plans and the materials, course materials, that might be too political, might be, and again, I'm not making up the Marxist thing. Our Republican Attorney General, Todd Rokita, is the one who suggested that schools are, in his words, teaching Marxist theory.
For my constituents in Vigo County, no. But I'm sure there are problems out there around the state. But again, there's a system in place for handling parental complaints, curriculum that you don't agree with. The bill that we did yesterday, which we'll talk about in a minute, because I want to make sure Tara gets to talk, it just changes what we're going to do in the classroom. And I think we're doing a great job right now. And as a lawmaker, I kind of like the General Assembly to treat us like professionals and let us do our job.
Terry Spradlin, again, you have your finger on school districts across the state because of your role with the association. Do you hear reports of the same types of things that the authors of some of these bills, where they've expressed concerns about what's being taught in the classroom and sort of the notion of potential brainwashing of kids? Do you get much of that bubbling up to you?
I've talked to legislators, you know, heading into the session, months ahead of the session. So I certainly heard from them that they heard from a few constituents. Certainly at some of our board meetings over the summer and fall, there was some divisiveness in the boardroom where groups of people came to share concern. But this is like legislating, swatting a fly with a sledgehammer. There are examples of a few what we would call great books or classic literature that has passages that subjectively some believe are sexually explicit material, not pornographic material, but sexually explicit material. So, you know, Huck Finn is one we often hear about as an example that can be debated. Is that a classic book or is that a sexually explicit piece of literature that we should take out of our school library? So it is subjective. We don't think the legislature should overreach on this. And there is a process locally. Anyone with concerns about literature or educational materials can talk to the classroom teacher, ask for alternative materials to be presented to their child. Usually that's approved. The parents can talk to the principal. It can be escalated to the board. And most school boards have a curricular review or textbook adoption committees, including parents, to review educational materials and textbooks and school library materials. So there's a process locally. We've managed this for years. It's not a crisis. It's a nuisance in some situations where folks have really latched onto this as a political agenda. And so, again, we hope people will calm down, let cooler heads prevail, and let's not, upset the apple cart for a few minor instances here and there throughout the state of Indiana.
How much of this is spurred national groups? I mean, we're seeing the same sorts of legislation almost verbatim showing up, as things often do, from state to state. And some states have enacted bans on so-called critical race theory, and which isn't taught in K-12 in Indiana. But is this something that is homegrown, or is this being fueled nationally, do you think?
Oh, absolutely national. There are groups, as you indicated, that have a political agenda. Some have said or suggested it's a midterm election strategy. It played out in the state of Virginia during their election cycle in 2021. And because of the outcome of that election, people have said, see, it works. Let's make school boards the battleground on social issues and create that divisiveness. So unfortunately, it has trickled into the state of Indiana as well. Again, there have been instances where boards had divisive meetings with individuals or groups of people coming to the boardroom with the intent to disrupt. And even if the topic for which they wanted to speak on was not on the agenda, they made sure to be heard, and oftentimes were disruptive, loud, shouting obscenities. There were some examples that were not, good examples of adult behavior with thoughtful, respectful, and civil engagement. And we should not condone that behavior. Oftentimes it escalated to the level of harassment or intimidation or even threat of some of our school board members. So that's not the type of governance model we want in the state of Indiana. Thankfully, that's kind of settled down. We're not really experiencing that right now in the boardroom. And we're hopeful, again, cooler heads will prevail with the legislature. Let's be pragmatic and practical, not overreach for something that's really not escalated to the degree that this legislation is warranted.
One bill that seems to have garnered some bipartisan support and has advanced out of its house of origin would be a requirement that school boards, in most circumstances, have in-person meetings. They would limit the types of circumstances, in a public health emergency where people could meet through Zoom and other electronic platforms. And more important, it would require public testimony or input if people want to talk. And one bill actually specifies 3 minutes per attendee. Tanya Paff, good idea to, sounds like the New England, schoolhouse, open the doors and let the public, the taxpayers come in and weigh in. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. So in my school corporation on the west side of Indiana, we have this, we've had it. We've had really long school board meetings because of public testimony, which is great. We want to hear from people. It's their tax dollars. So I have no problem with it. And the more we hear from people, the better, as long as it, doesn't take weeks to make a decision.
I was joking before the taping. Is this the new form of filibuster, where if you have a group of parents or taxpayers who are wanting to block an issue, say, I guess you could line up 100 or 200 true believers in the cause and have them, approach the microphone 3 minutes at a time. And that would push the meeting, the vote, probably to 6 a.m. On a meeting that starts the previous evening. Is that a real consideration?
So, most school boards, almost all, have always accommodated public comment. So there were a few, because of the divisiveness that they experienced with the threats and intimidation and harassment issues, that temporarily suspended public comment. But those two boards that I'm aware of have resumed recently public comment. So the public comment issue is not really something we would object to. We believe in it. We want to hear from parents. We want to hear from citizens and stakeholders in the community. School districts that are effective embrace parental engagement, embrace community involvement and partnerships. So giving them the avenue for First Amendment rights to be heard is something we support. But we do need the ability to manage the meeting effectively. We need our board president as chair, the ability to manage time and allocation of time so we can get through the board business. And there was one board meeting at Penn Harris Madison that went till 1 a.m. because of wanting to give everyone the opportunity to be heard. And typically it is 3 minutes that most boards have in their policy. So again, here's an example where, because of a couple of local issues, we're overreaching and legislating when we can really deal with this locally. The legislation is not needed, but we embrace public comment, so therefore we'll support the legislation. But it needs to be fixed to make sure we have discretion and managing the meeting so we can move on to other business.
And the input wouldn't stop if some of these bills are enacted with just input at formal school board meetings. Some of the legislation calls for the creation of advisory boards that would be made up of parents and others that would review course materials and curricula and the whole shebang, presumably with, I guess, veto power in some manner. I'm not sure that's clear about what happens if they disagree, if that's an automatic toss of that material or those lesson plans. Is that, that's clearly not enjoying as widespread support as the notion of public testimony at school board meetings. This one seems to be more of a difficult pill for school boards to swallow. Is that fair, Terry?
You know, again, as I mentioned earlier, we do have typically committees for textbook review, review of curricular materials. So, you know, the issue is, what are we charged with reviewing under the proposed legislation? It is A to Z, every grade level, every subject, you know, every year. That's an overreach. I don't think we'd have teachers who would want to sign up for that duty. It's just such a tall task. Really, we need discretion again locally with local control. If it's, say, a math textbook adoption year, that we look at math textbooks. If we have a public hearing and there are patrons who object to, you know, the identification of maybe 10 to 15 books in the library stacks, let us, you know, review those things, in, you know, on a limited basis. Or if a committee has more time and interest to look more broadly at the educational materials, that's fine. But we shouldn't mandate that every single school board have an advisory committee that must look at everything over the course of the year. It's unnecessary.
Tanya,
we already have processes in place.
Tanya Paff, do you agree? And Terry said not many teachers probably would be inclined to serve. Here's your invitation. A, would you serve on such a panel? And B, are such panels necessary?
So I've sat on many textbook adoption committees, and we've welcomed parents. In fact, it's probably 20 maybe 15 years ago, it was math adoption text time. So we went, we heard all about these different math textbooks, and this parent next to me is like, this is really boring. Well, you know, it is Algebra 1, it's Algebra 2. And so, you know, we welcome parental involvement. That's not what the issue is to me. The issue is, we are professionals. You know, I need to look at academic standards, pacing guide, the curriculum, and I need to pick the best books for my subject, be it elementary, be it middle school, science, whatever the case is. We're the professionals, you know, we have a degree, we know what we're doing, just let us do our job. And then, as Terry said, at the end, please, parents come in, but don't control 60% of the decision-making for what I'm supposed to teach in my classroom.
Well, and another provision would, in fact, make it easier, whether or not there's an advisory board, make it easier for parents, even those who aren't on an advisory board, to review and weigh in on course materials and whatnot, because there would be new requirements, and I think in many cases this is already done, but the posting of lesson plans and curricula and on a formal district website, with the ability of parents to, upon reviewing that, either opt out of certain types of plans and course materials, or say, my kid doesn't want to do this. Of course, then that opens the door to teachers, I suppose, having to come up with alternative plans. Terry Spradlin, is that more concerning from a philosophical standpoint or from a practical standpoint?
Or so a practical standpoint, you're right. We want to be transparent. Every school district has a learning management system where parents can log in, track their students' progress academically, what homework assignments have been given, what's being taught in the classroom. The historical model of parental engagement is this parent volunteering in the classroom, going on field trips, eating lunch in the cafeteria with their children. We still embrace that. We still have PTOs and PTAs. There are ways for parents to engage. I think this curriculum portal is a way for other stakeholders to engage on a political agenda to object to materials that they find inappropriate or not aligned to their philosophy or ideology. So that's the concern there. The biggest challenge is, from a practical standpoint, though, is that a teacher would have to post within 5 days their lesson plan. And teachers, because they're so crafted and skilled at what they do, they may change their lesson plan on the same subject three or four times in one day. And so we can't hamper or hamstring teachers to say, oh, wait a second, I forgot to post that. So now I can't teach this standard or this subject in a way that I'm skilled to teach it because Johnny or Sally aren't understanding. Now I need to change my lesson plan, but wait, I can't because it's not posted. It is hampering the skill, ability, and talent of teachers. And as Tanya mentioned earlier, this type of legislation will drive people out of the profession. So that's the concern with this legislation.
Well, and you talked about the fact that most districts, if not all, already have a policy where these things are posted and available for inspection. I guess what makes the added wrinkle here would be the notion that it's a two-way conversation, so to speak. You're not just as a parent or as a stakeholder in the community privy to the lesson plan, but if I understand the legislation as it's currently written, it would require districts to set up some mechanism where I could say, okay, my kid can do math, but social studies seems a little questionable this week, so no on that. And we're looking at sex education in PE class, so no to that. I mean, am I right? That's the way it would work. And am I right that teachers then would have to come up with alternatives? And if that is the case, Tanya Paff, does that, as Terry Spradlin suggests, make an already tough job that teachers have even tougher?
Absolutely. But the bigger challenge for me, again, I'm in the high school, is let's say a kid just doesn't want to learn the quadratic formula. And so they come in and they've opted out. So not only do I have to figure out a place for this student to go during my lesson, however long that lesson takes, I could be covering that for 3 days. So the student has to go somewhere else. I have to come up with something else for them to do. Fine, again, more work. But the bigger issue is that's going to be on the SAT. We're talking about AP classes, dual credit classes. If students are allowed to just opt out of something that they're uncomfortable with, talking about the Holocaust or evolution, you know, we have standardized tests that's going to affect how they perform on these tests. And I think that's a really big issue that we're not talking about very much. And I think that's a problem, especially with the uncomfortable topics. You know, sometimes you need a professional to explain those topics, talk about history, and then go home and talk to your parents about it. And that's the way we've done it for years. And again, to Terry's point, we're doing what we need to do. And, you know, just let us do what we do best.
Yeah, you know, at this point, most of the bills and provisions we've talked about are mechanisms by which parents and stakeholders can react to proposed lessons and course materials. We probably have overlooked, or at least not addressed yet, the most controversial provision, which is a more proactive prohibition on the teaching of certain, well, if not subjects. And I guess this gets in, we could spend a show or two just debating what the bill actually means. But basically, it instructs teachers to stay away or not to weigh in on issues that are divisive or where a one class of either gender or religious group or race can be felt to be superior or inferior or guilty for past misdeeds to another race. That again is probably the most controversial. Terry, is that if you had your gun sights set on certain provisions, is that number one on the list this session?
You know, that certainly has made the bill even more controversial. It's just such a big bill that just really does regulate what we do in the classroom on a daily basis. And, you know, if we're going to get our students to be college and career ready, we need our students to be critical thinkers, to be able to digest information, make some judgment of the information they've received, and then have conversation with their parents, have a dialogue with the teacher, have dialogue with fellow students about the subject matter. So, again, if we're going to narrow the scope here and, just only touch upon what 100% of the people will agree with all the time, we're almost, it's an impossibility standard. What will we be able to teach moving forward? Because we can't really meet that standard 100% of the time with 100% of agreement. So there's always going to be something a parent or a group of people will object to. And as Tanya mentioned, if we have that opt-out provision, what's left? I mean, it's, again, if, you know, I remember my stepdaughter calling her mom and saying, hey, can I stay home today? Because I really didn't prepare for my test. And of course, my wife said, no, you can't do that. But in this situation, you know, the child, the parent can opt out because, hey, Johnny's not really ready, doesn't understand the subject matter. And then what does that accomplish?
It would have remade my whole grade school career, I think, if I'd had that, my parents had had that option. Tanya Paff, last word goes to you. How do you balance? So much of this legislation is based on the notion that parents know best, and they're going to have the final say on everything from, you know, opting out of vaccine requirements and mask requirements or entire lesson plans and so forth. How do you balance the notion of parental intrusion and obstruction with what you've already discussed during the show here, which is a long-standing desire to have parents involved in the educational process?
You know, it's getting tougher and tougher to balance everything that the teachers do in the classroom. I mean, we've got a lot of demands on us, just like all the other professions. However, when parents think they know how to teach better than I do or want to opt their kids out of something uncomfortable, I think we need to go to why. I think we need to have these conversations just like we always have. So to me, this bill and a lot of these contentious bills, there's no reason. There might be a couple bad actors. And again, there's a system in place for taking care of those. But don't change the entire educational system because of a few people.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. The school bell has rung. We will have to continue the conversation either off camera or later in the session. Again, my guests have been Terry Spradlin, Executive Director of the Indiana School Boards Association, and State Representative Tanya Paff, a Terre Haute Democrat. Thanks so much. And time now for our weekly conversation with Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of the newsletter Indiana Legislative Insight and its sister publication, Indiana Education Insight, both part of HANA News Service. Ed, believe it or not, we're almost at the halfway point. What surprised you about what we've seen thus far?
I think it's credit to leadership that there was no disruption from COVID. I think that was something that, you know, certainly could have been anticipated at the beginning of the session. We're fortunate that we didn't have that, at least to date. What I really didn't expect was such a focus on educational issues from the social conservative perspective. I thought that we'd probably see a broader array of education issues evaluated, but not necessarily the so-called wedge issues that we have seen. A lot of concentration on fiscal matters to date. And then we've also seen some administrative law and executive agency issues come up in the context of executive versus legislative powers. And I think in the second half of the session, that's going to be a very important thing to watch.
What are you going to be watching for that? What do we need to be focused on over the next 5 weeks?
Well, I think that you're going to be watching to see what happens with the challenges in the political primaries in May from the right. A lot of social conservatives, people we thought were social conservatives, are being challenged by even more conservative candidates, and that may affect the way that they vote in the second half of this session.
Very good. Well, lots to watch. Ed, as always, appreciate your insight. Some say it's a crackdown on crime. Others say it's a threat to civil liberties. A look at the debate over criminal justice reform on the next Indiana Lawmakers. Until next week, take care.